There was an upsurge in bombings and shootings as violence flared between Iraq's two main religious communities. Long feared, civil war now seemed imminent. The authorities reacted by imposing daytime curfews, but the sectarian killings have continued, only more silently. Across Baghdad and in other cities with mixed communities, bodies have been turning up. Sometimes in mass graves, sometimes abandoned at the roadside, strangled or shot and some tortured. No one wants to talk about who's doing the killing, but no one has any doubt that in most cases, they're dying because of their religious identity, Shia or Sunni. The only way out of this cycle of violence, people say, is for a national unity government to be formed, bringing in all Iraq's ethnic and religious groups. But 3 months since the country went to the polls, Iraq is still in a political vacuum. The main factions cannot agree on who should get what job. They held their first parliament meeting since the elections last week, but broke up without any progress. Finding any hopeful signs in this is difficult, but there are some. Most of the violence is concentrated in a few areas, largely in and around Baghdad. Many other provinces are relatively secure in comparison. And US and British officials say Iraqi army units they've been training are taking over more responsibility. That's one reason why the UK is cutting its force in southern Iraq by 10% in the next few months. But for many Iraqis, life hasn't changed much in the past few years. They still suffer the same power cuts. Electricity generation hovers around the same levels as just before the invasion. 3 years since the US and British intervention in Iraq, there's still no clear end in sight.
Andrew North. So having listened to that with the Defence Secretary John Reid, who was in Baghdad, I put it to him that it wasn't just the violence that was worse, although it was, that since the invasion, even the basics of life hadn't improved. People couldn't even switch the lights on.
Well, I think what is true is that there is a mixed picture, that progress has been held up, particularly by the terrorists. But I don't think that while we're short of perfection, there hasn't been any progress, Jim. It occurred to me just as you were speaking and I was listening to Andrew's report there, that in the background here, you can probably hear both the singing of birds and the movement of helicopters. And that is, if you like, a sort of symbolic mixed picture of what's happened in Iraq. If you look at the three areas of build-up of democracy, which we wanted to support the Iraqis in doing, the build-up of their own security forces to protect it, and the economy, the picture is mixed. But there has been progress on democracy. We started off with 8 million people coming out to vote despite the threats of terrorists. Then in the referendum, 10.5 million. Then an astounding 12 million, 75% turnout in the most recent elections. And the fact that people who have lost hundreds of thousands of their colleagues in ethnic killings, in genocide attempts among the Kurds and the Shia Muslims during the Saddam years, are now sitting down with the Sunnis and working out a constitution. So progress, not perfection. Similarly in the build-up of the security forces, which has allowed us, as they take over more of their own security, to reduce our troop numbers. And similarly in civil society, you're right to point out that electricity is limited. On the other hand, balance that by pointing out that we now have 3,400 schools, for instance, rehabilitated, an immunisation programme that wasn't previously there.
Well, you use the word balance. I mean, it looks as if, on the best estimates, about 35,000 civilians have been killed in the aftermath of the invasion. The former head of the UN Human Rights Office in Iraq said the other day, the problem in Iraq is that nobody's safe. The utter lawlessness that prevails in the country is notorious. It's not governable. So long as there's no effective police force, and there isn't, and no effective judiciary, and there isn't, the country will continue to face this problem. So when you say progress but not perfection, I mean, no one's talking about perfection. People are talking about a country that works. And the problem is, it's a country that's racked by violence that is so deep that it's extremely difficult for people from outside to see where that progress is.
Yeah, but you see, that description that you gave just isn't true, Jim. If you look at, as your reporter accurately said, if you look at the spread of violence, the fact of the matter is that the vast majority of this is happening in 4 out of the 18 provinces, indeed, most of it in one area, which is Baghdad. In our area, for instance, where the British troops are, in multinational division southeast, there are 4 provinces, but only 2% of the incidents. Now, each of those incidents is a tragedy, of course it is. But it isn't true to say that the whole of Iraq is ungovernable or that everywhere is the same.
No.
Similarly, if you look at...
Look, this is the former head of the UN Human Rights Office, who wants progress, just as you do. And he says the country as a whole is ungovernable. You said to the Commons only the other day, there is more sectarian tension.
Well, yes, but with the greatest respect to whoever has said this, it isn't true that an increase in sectarian tension, even sectarian killings, means the whole country is ungovernable. It isn't. We've had 2 governments already, and it is true that there are negotiations going on for a third one. It wasn't 3 months ago the results became known. It was 2 months ago. But we know in areas where there has been conflict, even in our own country like Northern Ireland, it can take weeks and months to negotiate a government. That is going on here at present. Today I will meet President Talabani, I'll meet Prime Minister Jafari, and I will say to them that I believe that forming a government of national unity is the highest priority now for 2 reasons. One, where there is a vacuum in between governments after a general election, terrorists love a vacuum, so the longer it takes, the easier it is for terrorists to get involved there. But secondly, not only a speedy government, but one that brings in all of the groups in society, Sunni minority, as well as the Shia and the Kurds. That government of national unity is the biggest signal inside Iraq that the terrorists will not be allowed to do what they're trying to do, which is divide Iraqi from Iraqi, and the biggest signal to the world community that the Iraqi Democrats are united.
Yes,
that's why it's important, not because the country's ungovernable.
Well, let me put to you what Donald Rumsfeld said to Congress the other week at a hearing. He said, the plan is to prevent a civil war, and to the extent one were to occur, from a security standpoint, have the Iraqi security forces deal with it to the extent they're able to. Now, anybody listening to those words and reading them would conclude that Mr. Rumsfeld thinks that it is quite likely, maybe even overwhelmingly likely, that the security situation is going to get worse before it gets better. What do you think?
I have never denied that there has been, as a specific result of a specific attempt to divide Iraqis by the attack on the mosque, by the murder of part of the ethnic groups in terms of hundreds, indeed thousands, by the terrorists, remember, by the terrorists, that has had some success in pushing people back into the sectarian enclaves. That is not civil war. No. There is not civil war, nor is it inevitable, nor is it imminent. However,
is it likely?
If you take the view, I do not believe it is likely, and I believe it becomes less likely the more the Iraqi Democrats, who are supported by the vast majority of people in this country from all backgrounds, the more they come together and act in unity, like a national unity government, the less likely it is that the terrorists will succeed in their aim. So when people go in the streets of London today, I do wish just occasionally they'd go out in support of the United Nations, the Iraqi people,
and the
Iraqi
Democrats. Oh, they support the United
Nations
because most of the
people,
well, most of the people who will be demonstrating in London today are angry that you decided to go into Iraq without a specific UN mandate. So you can hardly accuse them of not wanting to support the UN.
Well,
it's that they wanted to support the UN originally.
Jim, let's hope then, Jim, that they support the United Nations, because it's under the United Nations Security Council resolutions that the Iraqis are building up the security forces, they're conducting their elections, they're trying to form a government, and that the multinational forces are now here operating.
Indeed,
so whatever happened, the argument
indeed,
of 3 years ago...
Indeed, but you know, I know that the Security Council and the General Secretary did not want the invasion as it was occurred. So let's put that into the mix as well.
Jim, you have a very simple choice in what's going on in Iraq today. You can support the Iraqi Democrats and the overwhelming majority of ordinary Iraqis who want peace, stability, a government of national unity and acting together to make sure there are more hospitals, there is a better life, there is more, there are fewer deaths. Or you can support, in effect, the terrorists by arguing that there is a civil war and that there is no democratic way of solving it. Now, I believe there is a democratic way of solving it, and that is what President Talabani, what Prime Minister Jafari, what Barzani, who the Kurd who I met yesterday, Dulami, the defence minister, who's a Sunni, the representatives of the Shia, that's what they believe can happen here, but the terrorists want to divide them and want to provoke a civil war.
We've got limited time, and I do want to raise one other matter. You're a former chairman of the Labour Party. Did you know that so much was being raised by loans? We now learn that the Chancellor didn't know, not just the Treasurer of the Labour Party. The Deputy Prime Minister didn't know. Did you know?
Look, the question is, Jim, have we made the system of financing for political parties more open, more honest, more transparent and better than it was? And under my chairmanship, as well as that of Charles Clark and I'm sure Ian McCartney, it is. However, it is patently clear that however it may have improved, it is not perfect. And well, it may well be, in my view, it may well be that as long as we are dependent on anyone for large donations, whether it be businessmen or whether it be trade union leaders, that will be an unsatisfactory position from the point of view of the public and the commentariat.
Would you have said that?
Yes, I happen to personally have been. I happen personally to be in favour of state funding for the past 25 years, Jim. However, I, along with many others, believe that it might have been sufficient to give complete transparency for donations and gifts, to make sure that there was a limit on them, to make sure they had to be declared. It is obvious that even though it is much better now than it was previously, largely as a result of our actions, that there are still concerns. And it may well be that we have to examine whether or not we go to a system where we have a greater level of state funding in order to diminish any reliance on any large donations from any section.
John Reid, thank you very much.
Now, at 17 minutes to nine, let's have a review of today's papers with Vaughan Savage.
There's further heat on the Prime Minister over what The Sun describes as Blair's £14 million sleaze loans. It's a murky business, the paper says, from which Labour and Tony Blair do not emerge well. The Daily Telegraph recalls that earlier scandals, some of which it regards as more serious, were quickly forgotten. But since the last election, the paper says, Labour has forfeited that most precious of political commodities, the benefit of the doubt. It says every day the Prime Minister remains in office, he damages his reputation, his successor and his party. The Daily Mail believes Mr. Blair's political authority is shattered and that his moral authority has finally imploded. But in his Downing Street bunker, the paper says, a Prime Minister in denial is still nominally in charge, still making plans as if it were business as usual. Matthew Paris in The Times talks of the duplicities and delusions of a lame duck leader. He declares Mr. Blair an out-and-out rascal and urges his allies to cut him loose soon. There is, he says, not much time to lose. A Guardian editorial calls on peers to stand firm as the government's ID cards bill ping-pongs between the Commons and the Lords. They should stick to their principles, the paper says, and reject the plans a fourth time. It accuses the Home Secretary, Charles Clark, of using disingenuous arguments. Great cathedral organs in Britain and the rest of Europe are under threat from an EU directive, according to The Times. Organ pipes have a lead content of 50% or more, some way above the 0.1% maximum permitted for electrical equipment under the new law. Every church organ in the country is potentially affected, the paper says, even though there are no known cases of anyone ever being poisoned by a pipe organ. The Daily Express predicts that the number of families hit by what it calls deathbed taxes will treble over the next 14 years. Continuing its campaign for the abolition of inheritance tax, it warns that 5 million households will suffer from what it calls the hated levy by 2020. The Sun claims that a terror suspect linked to Al-Qaeda has visited Parliament. The man, a former detainee, was apparently the guest of a Labour peer and claims to have spent some time in the Commons Public Gallery during his visit on Tuesday. The peer, Lord Ahmed, tells the paper that the man denies any link with Al-Qaeda and that he was not left alone for one second during his visit. The Home Office has admitted that handheld speed guns used by the police make mistakes, according to the Daily Mail. The admission is said to have come in a letter from a senior civil servant to a Hampshire solicitor who has defended scores of motorists. The Mail says it means that thousands of motorists have potentially lost their licences and even their livelihoods on false grounds. Smokers preparing to adjust to bans in pubs and clubs next year might feel the need to calm their nerves with a quick puff if they see the latest news from the land of the free in the Daily Telegraph. The Californian town of Calabasas has banned smoking outside, except in a few designated places, which have to be at least 20 feet away from any path, doorway, or place where people gather. The ban even covers residents' own balconies.
It's 13 minutes to nine. How do writers write? We know from Dan Brown of Da Vinci Code fame that he gets up at 4 o'clock in the morning, breaks for exercise from time to time, and seemingly goes into some kind of trance while he's doing it. All this came out in the plagiarism hearings this week. Well, let's ask a couple of writers, I should add, writers of a rather different stripe, how they do it. Alexander McCall-Smith joins us from Edinburgh. Will Self joins us from somewhere in the metropolis. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Now, I would never accuse either of you of writing a Dan Brown-style sentence, so let's get that out of the way. But, Alexander McCall-Smith, how do you do it? Everyone's fascinated by this. I mean, what's it like in your house when you get the urge and you start to write?
Well, I think that most writers have some sort of routine. I like to try to keep to a routine, although that can be difficult. And then one sits down, and I think then, to use a rather old-fashioned terminology, the muse takes over. I think the word trance that you used there is interesting. In a sense, one makes contact with one's subconscious mind, where I think all the fiction is being boiled up, and out it comes. And it's not a very conscious process.
Does that mean that you sometimes find that you have a good intention, you sit at the desk, you stare out the window, you have a cup of whatever it is, you raise your pen or put your fingers on the keyboard, and it just doesn't come? And if that happens, do you just stop and walk off and do something else for the rest of the day?
Well, I think if it's not going to work, then it becomes pretty apparent. But I think what one can do is set the circumstances in such a way that it does work. I like to listen to music, for example. I thoroughly recommend Mozart for writing. I think Mozart tends to bring it on, so to speak.
Divine simplicity. Well, look, Will, does that all sound familiar to you?
No, I'm not a muse person at all. I'm a perspiration, not inspiration person. set and setting, absolutely, I agree with Alexander on that. Routine, agree with that. Methodology, agree with that. And then you've got to make your word count or you can't get up from the desk. No Mozart, absolutely verboten. Interferes right with the rhythm of the prose.
But presumably, in your case, I know you've got a squirrel-like mind, and you gather stuff, you sort of store it, you organise it all, really before you begin, almost subconsciously.
Yes, I suppose, again, in fairness to Alexander, my musing takes place before I actually get to the keyboard. I've taken my notes, I've analysed them, I've taken many notes and probably planned pretty much what I want to do.
Now, Sandy McCall-Smith, is that the same with you? Or do you know your plot when you're beginning, or does it come?
Well, I have an idea what's going to happen, so yes. Rather like Will, I'd make a few notes, but my notes are pretty sparse. And then I sit down, and then I think a very curious thing happens, in that the characters and the action, the narrative, really acquire some sort of momentum of their own. So I can be writing something, and then a development will occur on the page which I hadn't anticipated. I'm often surprised by what happens.
Characters take
in
over.
The narrative. Yeah, characters take over, and they do things that you had no idea that they would do. It's, you know, sometimes one's surprised and shocked. It's great fun.
There are some writers, Will Self, who say that they sit down and they do whatever it is, 3 hours or 4 hours, bang, and that's it. The pen goes down, off they go, and have a glass of whatever it is, and come back the next morning and do the same. Could you work like that?
I do perforce have to work like that. I mean, there are some writers who have fixed word counts. I mean, Conrad notoriously wrote only 800 words a day, on which he managed to support a chauffeur, two maids, and an under butler.
You have none of those. Just let's check.
No, sadly not. But I think there is, you know, there is a virtue in having a fixed word count, because it just keeps the discipline level. Again, I agree. I mean, there is something that happens on the page. You can have unexpected turns of narrative and so forth, but and you can submerge into it. But I have to say it is a fairly laborious process to get to that point, I think.
And just finally, reassure us, Alexander McCall-Smith, that sometimes you do get page fright. You just see a blank screen or a blank sheet of paper, and you think, it's just not coming today.
Well, I suppose from time to time, although I must say I'm terribly lucky that way, that doesn't happen too often. May I just say about the word count that Flaubert would have regarded Conrad as being tremendously productive, because Flaubert apparently only did 35 words a day.
On that happy note, you do learn something every morning on this programme. Alexander McCall-Smith in Edinburgh, Lucky Man, and Will Self in London. Thank you both very much.
35 indeed. Words a day. Incredible. Now, if you want to hear Yesterday in Parliament, it's on BBC Radio 4 198 Long Wave now.
Now, residents in the Northern Territory of Australia are preparing a mass day of action against the marauding cane toad. The toxic amphibian has spread in plague-like numbers across tropical Australia since it was introduced in an attempt to eradicate the cane beetle 70 years ago. Now, millions of toads have had a terrible impact on native wildlife there, and this very day marks the beginning of a new community effort to stop them from advancing into Darwin itself. Phil Mercer reports from the Northern Territory.
A dangerous army is on the move. There could be as many as 100 million cane toads here in Australia's tropical north. A day of action is hoping to put a dent in this relentless advance. The toads have reached Darwin's outer suburbs. These streets are on the front line in what's become an increasingly desperate campaign to stop them. No one knows just how many of these toxic pests there are, but there could well be many millions heading this way.
They started off just near Townsville in 1935.
Tony Griffiths from Charles Darwin University says the march of the toads from eastern Australia has been unstoppable.
They're currently moving into Darwin and also heading for the West Australian border. So they've kind of colonised the entire tropical area of Queensland. And it looks like their rate of colonisation is actually increasing.
And this is what all the fuss is about. Two cane toads trapped in a box here in suburban Darwin. There's a smaller male and an absolutely enormous female. Now, these creatures are big, they're ugly, and they're public enemy number one.
Yeah, I'm Graham Sawyer. I'm the Joint Coordinator for Frogwatch North. The biggest issue with cane toads is the impact they have right across the spectrum on native wildlife. And Darwin's pretty much a unique place in relation to its wildlife. You know, in a school ground like this, for example, there's probably frill-neck lizards and stuff. And every parkland and nearly every school ground in Darwin's got those sort of animals. If we don't do something about cane toads, then in 5 years' time, those things will all be gone.
Dogs as well as crocodiles and dingoes have also died after eating cane toads. No one's quite sure how to get rid of them. Traps have been effective, but Federal MP Dave Tolner recommends a far more controversial method.
I suggested that people should hit them with golf clubs or cricket bats or, you know, lumps of wood, whatever it was at hand. Other people have suggested that you should put them in a box and then gas them with the exhaust of your car. The RSPCA also suggests chemical euthanasia. You know, to me it seems far easier just to flog them over the head with a lump of wood.
That's not an approach supported by Australia's RSPCA. It believes the toads are a menace and should be eliminated. Lindsay Wilkinson from the RSPCA in Darwin believes that a humane solution lies in the bathroom cabinet.
Realistically, hemorrhoid cream is a viable option. The active ingredient in hemorrhoid cream is benzocaine, and it's a local anaesthetic. You put a strip of that onto the cane toad's back. I mean, they're not going to move anywhere. They don't hop away. And 10 minutes later, the cane toad's comatose, and you just throw them in your freezer.
The toads have found an ideal home in Australia's lush tropics. Encouraging residents to defend the front line will make a difference, but they almost certainly won't stop the advance of this toxic scourge.
Phil Mercer and the marauding cane toads. The time now, 5 to 9. You might not fancy the idea of living to 160, but a group of scientists and economists are discussing that possibility, among others, as they debate how our societies might look many years from now. All this week, Oxford University's Said Business School has been running a world forum on science and civilization. Among the participants, Robin Hansen, who's Associate Professor of Economics at George Mason University in Virginia, and Dr. Aubrey de Grey from the Department of Genetics at Cambridge University. Welcome to the programme, both of you. Good morning.
Hello. Good morning.
Now, Robin Hansen, let me ask you first about something that is quite controversial, the suggestion that computers will take over, that computers could even start to keep humans as pets. Tell me what you think about that.
I don't have much thoughts about the pet concept, but people have been warning about robots or computers or artificial intelligence coming for not only decades but hundreds of years, and I think it will eventually come.
But it's always a very scary prospect, isn't it? If you think of the films, for example, I wouldn't use that as a main source material, but Terminator certainly scared the life out of many people.
Well, it's got a lot of material for dramatic stories, but I think the truth will be a little more peaceful than that.
How would it work then? How far do you think robotics will develop?
Well, eventually the robots will be good enough to substitute for people. Eventually they will be faster, cheaper, better than ordinary human labor. And at that point, people would rather hire them than us.
Are you saying that humans will simply enjoy themselves?
Yes, presuming you have enough wealth stored away in some other form, you can be rich, part of the new idle rich.
It still sounds a bit alarming, doesn't it? Dr. Aubrey de Grey, what do you think? Do you think that computers could take over, or are you one of the people who thinks that we should possibly be able to live to a grand old age in future?
Well, the question of whether artificial intelligence will get into this, what you might think of as a runaway mode, where it becomes rapidly, rapidly more intelligent, is something that, as Robin said, has been discussed for a long time. Something that is very much unclear and unpredictable is whether the earlier stage of improvement of the intelligence and autonomy of machines will find enough market pressure, so to speak, enough public enthusiasm to push it further forward. We can see in many other past technologies that technology moves forward relatively rapidly when there is public pressure there. We can think of, for example, powered flight, and then it gets to a point where somehow we can't be bothered anymore. And so, for example, there were no successors to Concorde in supersonic commercial airlines. And I think that sort of question is the really hardest question to answer in the development of artificial intelligence.
If we do live to ages, say, 160, are you saying that there are the medical advances that could possibly allow that to happen? And is it healthy for a society to be living that long?
The medical wherewithal to allow us to live to 160 certainly does not exist yet. And I think that it will probably be, well, it will certainly be a couple of decades, probably a little longer than that, before we manage it. And it could be a lot longer than that. This is, of course, relatively distant science and therefore emphatically very speculative. However, I can't see any immediate barriers to it, and indeed my work consists of describing in some detail how, at this point, it seems we might be able to go about developing those technologies on a timescale of decades. Whether it's healthy for such a society to exist is another very different question. And at this point, I would say I'm optimistic. I think that there is no reason why a society of indefinitely old people and indefinitely increasingly wise people should not be a healthy society.
Well, Robin Hansen, you could have old people then living alongside computers.
We could. I'd say more than just saying maybe it sounds good. I'd say standard economic theory suggests it would be good to have people living longer.
But if you think about pensions and the whole retirement issue, difficult.
Yeah, the political system has unfortunately made some deals tied to specific age numbers, and that throws a monkey in the wrench in the works.
I think we'll have to call it a day there. Robin Hansen and Dr. Aubrey de Grey, thank you both very much for joining us.
Emails coming in, and I'm afraid the Cervantes business gets more complicated. Ian Hunter is emailed in the following terms. Cervantes, coming from north of Madrid, wouldn't have used the guttural J or Jota at the time of writing Don Quixote, Quixote, or whatever it is. It's much more likely he himself would have pronounced the Don's name as Quixote. There you are. Our editors today, Witzke Barima and Richard Knight, have a very nice weekend from Cal and me. Good morning.
Good morning.